Okay, I think everybody is here now, and welcome to the people overseas who are watching this Sutagrass live on the internet. So, and all the people here, please don't make silly requests, because this is going international. Please turn off your mobile phones, because people in the far reaches of the universe will hear it. Here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, for today's Sutagrass, the first of 2,555, Buddhist calendar, that's two ha-ha-ha in Thai. We're doing the 67th Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Chaturmāsa Sutta. And the reason that I've chosen to talk about this sutta today is because it's not on the list of the suttas which have already been done and talked about. So there are a few suttas from this book which have been left out, and there are reasons for it being left out. It may not be as inspiring as some of the other suttas, but it's still got some interesting stuff to say. And in particular, this sutta was directed at monks, but I think as I read it out, you can understand where the Buddha was talking to monks. The same applies to nuns, the same applies to anybody who's really pursuing the path to enlightenment. And it also gives everybody a very, very full view of how the Buddha taught. And then sometimes to the lay people, sometimes to kings, sometimes even to prostitutes, sometimes to the monks, sometimes to the nuns, sometimes to the naughty monks, sometimes to the great nuns. It had a whole range of teachings. So this was to a group of monks. And it also gives you an idea of just what's expected of monks. Many 2,500, almost 2,600 years ago now, and also what's expected of monks and nuns today. So here we go. This is Sutta 67, Chaturmāsa Sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion a Blessed One was living at Chaturmāsa in a Myrobalan grove. And for those of you who don't know what Myrobalan is, it's one of those little fruits which if you eat them give you diarrhea. It's a laxative. And I'm not sure why it was in those days, but many of the monks and would actually, or lay people as well, would eat that to overcome their digestive problems. And even these days, in the forest tradition, some monks are so desperate to eat something in the evening, they eat this stuff. I only ate it once, and that was it. That was the end of it. Never again would I spend all night on the toilet eating that stuff, especially when there was only a few toilets and a great queue. So I don't know why people do this, but anyway, that's what a Myrobalan is. Now, on that occasion, 500 monks, headed by the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Mahamoggallana, had come to Chaturmāsa to see the Blessed One. Now, you all know that Venerable Sariputta and Mahamoggallana were the two chief monks, and these were some of their disciples, so this would be located in the latter part of the Buddha's teaching career. And it says in the commentaries, and this makes a lot of sense to me, that Venerable Sariputta and Mahamoggallana would share the teaching of the monks. Obviously the nuns would teach the nuns. And Venerable Sariputta would teach his disciple up to the stage of being a stream winner. And once they become a stream winner, then he would let them go, because he knew that once they had seen the Dhamma, that would be enough for them to continue further. Whereas Mahamoggallana, his difference was, he'd teach them to make sure they had the experience of the jhanas. And once they had the jhanas, then they could be by themselves. It's interesting, just slightly different tendencies of those two monks. But still, more than enough to get the monks started on the path. So once they got to a certain stage, they knew the teachings, they had enough power in meditation or wisdom, then they could become independent and go the rest of the way in solitude by themselves. So this was almost like the basic training a very high basic training, but still the basic training before the monks would be off by themselves. So they'd had 500 disciples. The 500 in Nepali is never a precise number. It means somewhere around that number of monks. And so they came to see the Buddha. Monks would wander around from place to place. When they heard the Buddha was at this Chatuma, they would come to visit. And while the visiting monks were exchanging greetings with the resident monks and were preparing resting places and putting away their bowls and outer robes, they were very loud and noisy. And sometimes if you come to Bodhinyana Monastery, sometimes you see the same. Because when there's more than two or three monks, there's always some talking, there's always some business to be done. And sometimes the monks are talking four or five conversations in the one room and it gets very noisy. And that's why that the training I had as a young monk was only one conversation at a time was be in the room. That'd be the senior monk and everyone else would stay quiet. And that was very, very beautiful. But it's hard in Western countries to just have one conversation in the room. Because we're used to four, five, six or seven, eight conversations going on at the same time. And sometimes this is very disturbing. In fact, I was so well trained, if you know this story, I was so well trained to keep quiet that when I first came here to Australia as the second monk to Ajahn Chakravo, I was so quiet, I'd hardly ever say a word. He would be doing the teaching, he would be doing the answering of any questions, and he would also be just saying hello to a person. My job, my training told me was just to look after him, to serve him. If I needed a job doing, I would go and get him some water or a cup of tea. That was my job, but I kept very quiet. But then after about 6 months, he went to Thailand for a visit, so I had to do the teaching. And I still remember this young lady, about 14 or 50. As soon as I gave her some talks, she came up to me afterwards and she said, "That's amazing. I'm really so surprised you can speak. I thought you were brain damaged before." Because she'd never seen anyone being so quiet and silent. She thought there was something seriously wrong with me. And I take that as a compliment. But anyway, so while the visiting monks were exchanging greetings with the resident monks and were preparing resting places and putting away their bowls and outer robes, they were very loud and noisy. Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Ananda. "Ananda, who are these loud, noisy people? One would think they were fishermen hawking fish. You know, somebody over here in Fremantle Market or Petticoat Lane or any other noisy place." And Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, replied, "Venerable Sir, they are 500 monks headed by Sariputta and Moggallana who have come to Chatuma to see the Blessed One. And while the visiting monks were exchanging greetings with the resident monks and were preparing resting places and putting away their bowls and outer robes, they have been very loud and noisy. Then, Ananda, tell those monks in my name, the teacher calls the Venerable Ones." "Yes, Venerable Sir," he replied, and he went to those monks and told them, "The teacher calls the Venerable Ones." "Yes, Ven," they replied, and they went to see the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. When they had done so, the Blessed One, the Buddha, asked them, "Monks, why are you so loud and noisy? One would think you were fishermen hawking fish." "Venerable Sir, we are 500 monks headed by Sariputta and Moggallana who have come to Chatuma to see the Blessed One. And it was while we visiting monks were exchanging greetings with the resident monks and were preparing resting places and putting away our bowls and outer robes that we were very loud and noisy. Go, monks. I dismiss you. You cannot live with me." "Yes, Venerable Sir," they replied. And they rose from their seats, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on their right, they put away the things in their resting places, and taking the bowls and outer robes, they departed. They were sent away. Now, on that occasion, the Sakyans of Chatuma, because Chatuma was a town in the Sakyan Republic, even though it was a republic, it was very much dependent on the kingdom of Kosala, but they had a degree of independence. So the Sakyans, the villagers, the townspeople who lived close by, had met together in the assembly hall for some business or other. Now, because it was a republic, all of their decisions were done on a democratic system, and that assembly hall was where they met to discuss any business which needed to be done. In fact, the Pali word for that assembly hall is called Sabha. And anyone who knows anything about politics, that is the word for the Indian Parliament in New Delhi, the Sabha. Because that was a democracy which was there in the time of the Buddha. The Republic of the Sakyans and also the Republic of the Lichavis at Vaisali, they would meet together on business and they had to attend to discuss matters. Very, very similar to what was happening in Greece about the same time. And it's a matter of some debate which actually came first, but certainly they were contemporaneous. And so the idea that democracy started in Greece is invalid. It was there in India at the same time. And interestingly, it was that democratic system which was in places like the Lichavi Kingdom, Lichavi Republic at Vaisali, the Wajin Republic, which became the standard adapted for the Sangha, and which we still keep to this day. So when they had met together, they seeing the monks coming in the distance, they went to them and asked, "Where are you going, venerable sirs?" And the monks replied, "Friends, the Sangha of monks has been dismissed by the Blessed One." And obviously being dismissed, you know, really meant they'd been sent away. "Then let the venerable ones be seated a while. Perhaps we shall be able to restore the Buddha's confidence in you." "Yes, friends," they replied. Then the Sakyans of Chattama went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down on one side and said, "Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One delight in the Sangha of monks. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One welcome the Sangha of monks. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One show compassion towards the Sangha of monks, now as he used to show compassion towards it in the past. Venerable Sir, there are new monks here, just gone forth, recently come to this Dhamma and discipline, this training. If they get no opportunity to see the Blessed One, there may take place in them some change or alteration. Venerable Sir, just as when young seedlings get no water, there may take in them some change or alteration. So too, Venerable Sir, there are new monks here, just gone forth, recently come to this Dhamma and discipline. If they get no opportunity to see the Buddha, there may take place in them some change or alteration. Venerable Sir, just as when a young calf does not see its mother, there may take place in it some change or alteration. So too, Venerable Sir, there are new monks here, just gone forth, recently come to this Dhamma and discipline. If they get no opportunity to see the Blessed One, there may take place in them some change or alteration. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One delight in the Sangha of the monks. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One welcome the Sangha of monks. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One show compassion on the Sangha of monks, now as he used to show compassion in the past." So they're trying to intercede to ask the Buddha, said, give them a break. No, they really need you. But anyway, we see what happens next. So it does not say here, but it's implied that their arguments to the Buddha were not received, because then they got what we call the big shots to come down. Then Brahma Sahampati came down to try and intercede. Now, Brahma Sahampati, he was the same person who came to see the Buddha just after his enlightenment. If you look elsewhere in the suttas, Brahma Sahampati, they called him Brahma, but he was an anagami, a non-returner. Now, non-returners, if they get to that stage of having totally overcome the five lower fetters, and those of our members here who are at my New Year's Eve party would know the five lower fetters now, because we acted them out. In particular, any sort of desire for the five sense world, any ill will, the self-view, all that has been overcome. There's three of the main five. So they never get reborn in this world, but they spend some time in what's called the Sudarvasa, the pure abodes. I would say that they spend a lot of that time in the jhanas. And because they're not totally in the jhana realms, they're in the Sudarvasa, they can actually come back and just check out what's going on here in this earth, especially if they too were fellow monks. And it seems Sahampati was also a monk under Kassapa the Buddha, as was Siddhartha Gautama in a previous life. And so because they were friends from a past life, monks under the previous Buddha Kassapa, that connection there is one explanation why Brahma Sahampati would often come down to talk with the Buddha. First of all, to get him to teach. And you can see now, when the Buddha was stopping teaching the monks, coming down again, come on, please teach the monks. So you can see his place in this story. Is there any questions about that before we carry on? Yes, Daniel. Could you wait for a moment for the... because this is going live on the internet.
Is there an explanation why the Buddha had to be taught? Because in other suttas we were told that whatever the Buddha pays attention to, he would know fully, like he's all-knowing whatever aspect. And in this case, even though he paid attention to the monks, he didn't know that they needed to be taught. So how do we understand that he needed himself to be taught and he's not like, you know, the greatest teacher? Well, it gives that impression, obviously, you know,
okay.
The greatest. But.
Now, it's this... is asking a question which is probably was going to be answered later on. But you can see later on in the sutta, the Buddha obviously does go and teach the monks again. This was not the end of his teaching career. And it seems more likely to have been what we call these days an object lesson. You know, to just tell the monks, look, it's really serious that you keep quiet. So it's like saying, well, I'm not going to teach you anymore. You know, what he really means, you know, until you start behaving again. And then I can teach you to make it very clear to these monks that, you know, the quietness, mindfulness when you are visiting a monastery, when you put your things away, keeping that quietness there is really, really important. So I think it's more like an object lesson. There's no way, it's out of character with everything else we know about the Buddha, for him to have a moment of peak to what they say in Australia, to spit the dummy and say, right, that's it. I'm going to stay by myself from now on. And this becomes quite evident later on in this sutta. So I think Brahma Sahampati and also those townspeople of Chatham didn't really need to go and see the Buddha. You know, it wasn't really necessary that they asked him, because the Buddha would have after a while taught the other monks. Does that answer your question? So Brahma Sahampati knew with his mind the thought in the Blessed One's mind, because living in a different realm. So just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, he vanished in the Brahma world and appeared before the Blessed One. Then he arranged his upper robe on one shoulder and, extending his hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One, said this. In other words, even though he was, like you call him, heavenly being, still he would appear, you know, in this realm, in this world, exactly as other people would appear. So if Brahma Sahampati, you know, appeared, say, you know, in UK, he'd be wearing a nice suit and maybe a bowler hat. If Brahma Sahampati appeared in Australia, you know, he'd be wearing some shorts and a singlet. So they'd appear in the natural garb of the people at that time. So then he arranged his upper robe on one shoulder, extending his arms in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One, said, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One delight in the Sangha of monks. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One welcome the Sangha of monks, using the same words as the townspeople of Chatuma. So it's just a repetition there. Now the Sakyans, as I said, the Sakyans of Chatuma and the Brahma Sahampati were able to restore the Blessed One's confidence with the similes of the seedlings and the young calf. I think at least that's what it appeared to be, but I'm sure the Blessed One the Buddha was actually waiting to be have his confidence restored. Because I said earlier, it would have been just a matter of teaching, sending people away until they could be properly taught. And so then the Venerable Mahamogala addressed the monks thus. Get up, friends, take your bowls and outer robes. The Blessed One's confidence has been restored by the Sakyas of Chatuma and the Brahma Sahampati with the similes of the seedlings and the young calf. Yes, friend, they replied, and taking their bowls and outer robes, they went to the Blessed One. And I don't say they made a great noise. I'm sure that they were incredibly quiet when they came. And after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. When they had done so, the Buddha asked the Venerable Sariputta, what did you think, Sariputta, when the Sangha of monks was dismissed by me? Venerable Sir, I thought thus, the Sangha of monks has been dismissed by the Blessed One. The Blessed One will now abide inactive, devoted to pleasant abidings here and now. And that means jhanas. That's the word for jhanas, the idiom in the Tripitaka. The Blessed One will now abide inactive, devoted to jhanas, and we too shall now abide inactive, devoted to jhanas. Stop, Sariputta. Stop. Such a thought should not be entertained by you again. That's interesting. Why? But, of course, poor Sariputta, even though he's the wisest of monks, he answered first. And Moggallana realized that was a wrong answer, and so had a better chance of getting the right answer right. It's always best to be second when you answer questions. Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Mahamoggallana. What did you think, Moggallana, when the Sangha of monks was dismissed by me? Venerable Sir, I thought thus. The Sangha of monks has been dismissed by the Blessed One. The Blessed One will now abide inactive, devoted to jhanas. Now the Venerable Sariputta and I shall lead the Sangha of monks. Good, good, Moggallana. Either I shall lead the Sangha of monks, or else Sariputta and Moggallana should lead it. So what he was actually saying there, how I understand that it is important, for senior monks, not just to abide inactive, devoted to the jhanas, but also to do their duty in teaching others. Because if the Buddha is there, wonderful. But if the Buddha's not there, then each one of us has to shoulder our burden and also to teach. Because otherwise, with the simile of the calf, the simile of the seedling, without people leading and teaching and inspiring, of course, the Sangha and Buddhism is very likely to disappear. So it's almost from this I get the fact that we do have a duty, certainly to understand these teachings, to realize them, penetrate them, and become them in the sense of gaining those attainments and then doing the teaching, especially now the Blessed One has gone. So it's not just, as people sometimes say, that Buddhism is very personal, just looking after yourself, and the Buddha is saying, no, you should never do that. Spend some time looking after yourself, but some time also working for the happiness, harmony, and the growth in wisdom and compassion and relinquishment of all sentient beings. Any questions on that? Okay, so then the Blessed One addressed the monks thus. So he's addressing the monks, having informed the leaders, Sariputra and Moggallana, about basically why he had said that he wasn't going to teach. Let Sariputra and Moggallana teach these monks. Now he's coming to do his duty, the Buddha's duty of teaching those monks. So he's giving them a simile here of the four perils in the water. And this is for monks. If it is for nuns, if you're saying for bhikkhunis, you see one of these perils is the sharks. That would be, they say here, where has it gone? It's for crocodiles, for whirlpools, for sharks. The shark one is for monks, it's for women. And for the bhikkhunis, it will be the men. For any gay monks or gay nuns, it will be people of the same gender. So it's just actually saying, what are some of the dangers for people who are living a celibate life? So, he was giving a simile, and of course this is mostly for monks, which is one of the reasons why you haven't heard this talk being discussed, this sutta being discussed in public before. But so too, monks, there are four kinds, the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, paragraph 14. Monks, there are these four kinds of fears to be expected by those who go down to the water. What are the four? They are fear of waves, fear of crocodiles, fear of whirlpools, and fear of sharks. These are the four kinds of fears to be expected by those who go down to the water. And here in Western Australia, we certainly know about crocodiles, saltwater crocs, and sharks. Whirlpools. Do we have any whirlpools in Western Australia? Maybe somewhere, but they're not such a problem. But certainly crocodiles and sharks we have. So too, monks, there are four kinds of fears to be expected by certain persons, not all persons, certain persons, who have gone forth from the home life into homelessness in this Dharma and discipline. In other words, those who have actually become novices, monks, nuns, seminaries. What are the four? They are the fear of waves. It should really be the danger of waves rather than the fear. The danger of waves, the danger of crocodiles, the danger of whirlpools, and the danger of sharks. So what is the danger of waves? Here's some clansman, just a good person, goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, considering, I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. Now, first of all, it is contained in that statement that the people in that time understood and accepted the truth of rebirth, reincarnation. And they knew that, yes, they may be having a reasonably good life in this time, but in their next life, who knows what might happen. So they weren't just judging their happiness just on this transitory one life that they were in the middle of. They're realizing that where they come from, where they're going, is much, maybe a bit more uncertain. So therefore they wanted to find out just how there can be an end of all of this. So they were a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, grief, and pain, grief, and despair. As somebody just told me recently, they said in some of the suttas there, they said that even if you do go to a heaven realm after this life, many people, after they have their time in heaven, go actually to a lower realm, below this human realm, after they pass away from heaven. And he was getting very concerned that, even this human life can be pretty bad. Imagine being reborn, as a cow in Indonesia, or a pig somewhere, or even a lower animal. It's a very, very unpleasant life as an animal. And so, realizing that this thing which we're involved in, samsara, life after life after life after life after life after life, is not something which we can look forward to with a sense of eager anticipation of happiness. You are a prey to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Even in this one life, there's enough suffering, this human life. And we're living in a good country, we have good health care, we are wealthy, and we are well fed. So how much are other lives a bunch of suffering? So realizing you're a victim of this birth, aging, and death process called reincarnation. You're a victim of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. You're a victim of suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. As I mentioned in other talks, that is why people come to places like this, to try and find some wise ways to lessening the suffering in this life. And if you really are smart and you really get into the wisdom teachings gained from deep meditation, you'll find out that the real big problem is not just this life, it's many lives. So how can we end this suffering once and for all? So they have a bit of faith that this teaching will give you a real, true end to suffering, not in this life, but evermore. So surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. In the time of the Buddha, that was the motivation to become a monk or a nun. that after he has gone forth thus, his companions in the holy life advise and instruct him thus. You should move to and fro thus. You should look ahead and look away thus. You should flex and extend the limbs thus. You should wear the patched cloak, the robe, the bowl and robes thus. Then he thinks, formerly when we were in the home life, we advised and instructed others. And now these bhikkhus, who seem like they may be our sons or our grandsons, think that they can advise and instruct us. In other words, the pride of, you know, if you have been your own boss in your household, you've been free, and you enter some sort of training, especially in a monastery where some young monks have to teach you, sometimes you get very, very upset. So, not wanting to be trained by people you think is inferior to you, you forsake the training and revert to the low life. He is called one who has forsaken the training and reverting to the low life because he was frightened by the danger of waves. Now, waves is a term for anger. Angry despair, but despair here really means just, you know, the bad state of mind. And obviously coming here from pride. And it is true that sometimes we get some important people end up becoming monks, and they have to sit at the end of the line and get the last of the food. And they have been wealthy people before. They may have had servants in their house, and now they have to sort of beg for their food. There is one of our friends, and his father is the second wealthiest man in Malaysia. This monk came to stay here for a while, so his father actually visited, you know, in his private plane, parked at Perth Airport, and just went to see his son in Bodhinyana Monastery some years ago. So this was one wealthy man, second wealthiest man in Malaysia, and he sort of opines, my son, he begs for his food every morning, and I'm the second wealthiest man in Malaysia, I've only got one son, why is he doing this? Well, that's a very good monk because, you know, he hasn't got that pride. But you can imagine what it would be like, you know, to be someone who's a boss and then being in the bottom of the line and having to serve other people. It's a tough thing to do, but obviously it's a very good training. So that fear of pride when you come to a monastery and become a monk is a very difficult thing to do. I remember even the second year I was a monk in Thailand, the headman of the local village of Bung Wai decided to spend the rains retreat, you know, not as a monk, but just as the eighth preceptor. And he had such a difficult time. He was the headman of the village, and people would respect him. And now he had to clean the toilets and clean the spittoons. It was a difficult thing for him to do. But it was a wonderful training for him. He almost didn't last, but he managed to pull through in the end. So really good for him. So that's what they mean by the fear of waves. And some of the women at Dhammasara, they have, you know, been successful women in their own right. And sometimes there's bhikkhunis I know who've been professors with tenure at the university. Very, very intelligent with lots of students. And when they first become a bhikkhuni, you know, sometimes they look down upon it and said, what, you can't find a husband? You know, why are you a bhikkhuni? Are you a loser or whatever? And these were very, very highly attained, competent women. So that sometimes that when you join the Sangha, sometimes you can be open for abuse. So that's actually where, never get angry at that status. So I was writing a little article today that even when I first came here, once when I was down teaching in the prison in Bunbury, I was had a free afternoon, so it was one of those days that I went down to the beach and just did some meditation. It's a quiet place. And as I was sitting quietly, something flashed by my ear, whizzed by my ear, and I turned around and saw it was a stone. And there were some kids throwing stones at me. And so, you know, that's the fear of angry despair. But instead of getting angry, you know, when you were being abused, I did the right thing. Because after three or four stones went by and I'm getting closer, I realized I had to do something. And running away is not the option. So I got up and walked towards the kids. And of course they ran away. All except one who stayed. They said, what are you doing that for? I'm a monk. And they didn't realize I was a Buddhist monk. So they apologized afterwards. But you know, that's what happens there. That sometimes you may have been an important person. When you become a monk, you have to go down the social status in some places. So what monks is the fear of crocodiles? Now, what do we know about crocodiles? Crocodiles have got these huge mouths. So the fear of crocodiles, or the danger of crocodiles for monks, is the food. And of course, any of you who have been either to Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentai or Dhammasara Monastery know that the food there is not just one meal a day, as Ajahn Samedi used to say, but one banquet a day. So, what monks is the fear of crocodiles? Here some clansman goes forth out of faith, from home life into homelessness, considering I am a victim of birth, aging and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. Then after he has gone forth thus, his companions in the holy life advise and instruct him thus. This can be eaten by you. This can't be eaten by you. This can be consumed and eaten, just words for similar meaning. This can be eaten by you. This cannot be eaten by you. This can be tasted by you. This cannot be tasted by you. This can be drunk by you. This cannot be drunk by you. You can consume what is allowable. You can't consume what is not allowable. You can eat what is allowable. You can't eat what is not allowable. You can taste what is allowable. You cannot taste what is not allowable. You can drink what is allowable. You can't drink what is not allowable. You can consume food in the morning. You can't consume it in the afternoon or evening. You can eat within the proper time. You can't eat outside the proper time. You can taste food in the proper time. You cannot taste food outside the proper time. You can drink within the proper time. You can't drink outside the proper time. All these rules and regulations about food. Then he thinks, formerly, when we were at home, we can eat whatever we liked and didn't eat what we didn't like. We ate what we liked, didn't eat what we did not like, tasted what we liked, did not taste what we did not like, drank what we liked, did not drink what we did not like, consumed what was allowable and what was not allowable as well. We ate what was allowable and what was not allowable, tasted what was allowable and what was not allowable, and drank what was allowable and what was not allowable. We consumed food within the proper time and outside the proper time, and both. We ate within the proper time and outside the proper time. We tasted, we drank, we did everything whenever we wanted. Now when faithful householders give us food of various kinds during the day, outside the proper time, it seems like these monks put a muzzle on our mouths. And so he forsakes the train and reverts to the lowlife. He is called one who has forsaken the training and reverted to the lowlife because he was frightened by the danger of crocodiles. Now, crocodiles is a term for gluttony, for food, because big mouths. So sometimes that is a bit difficult. Sometimes that's one of the reasons why people even don't come to retreats where we keep the 8 precepts. They think, oh, I'm not eating in the afternoon. Having nothing, no supper, no dinner, no snacks, I'm going to die. And of course, it's just a fear, it's not a truth. Anybody who's gone and done 8 precepts, after 1 or 2 days, you are fine. You don't die, we've had no casualties yet. I know some people think, oh, it would be wonderful to keep 8 precepts and not have any food in the afternoon or evening. I will lose weight. But I've been doing this for 37 years, and it doesn't work. Still, you can put on weight. So it shows you can be healthy even on one meal a day, or even too healthy. But it's the main thing over there with that crocodile is feel like being controlled all the time. And you think, why do I have to keep these rules? And obviously the reason why we do have those rules later on, it isn't said here, but it is all said elsewhere. It is to restrain oneself for simplicity and also to restrain. The first one is restraining pride. So one can be told by others what to do. Doesn't matter how senior you were, you know, you can be told by others, you're doing it wrong, please do it this way, not that way. And the second one, that you can restrain some of your desires for food. You don't always have to eat, you know, what you want and when you want it. And of course, that was a very big thing for me. Like most people, you know, going to a place like Northeast Thailand with food which even Bangkok Thais, they couldn't stomach and they hated it, let alone for a Westerner. I remember talking with other Westerners. Myself, I travelled around the world a lot, even before I went to Northeast Thailand, and other people had been travellers too. And we've been, you know, to places in Africa and Central America, and we all agreed that that was the worst food in the whole world in Northeast Thailand. It was really disgusting stuff. But we just had to eat it. And so you managed to survive. Because we overcame the fear of crocodiles, gluttony, or eating what you want when you want it. What monks is the fear of whirlpools? Here some clansman goes forth out of faith and the home life into homelessness, considering I'm the victim of birth, aging, and death. From sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, I'm a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. Then after he has gone forth thus, when it is morning, he dresses and taking his bowl and outer robe, he goes into a village or town for alms round, with his body unguarded, with his speech unguarded, with mindfulness unestablished, with his sense faculties unrestrained. He sees some householder there, or householder's son, furnished and endowed with the five courses of sensual pleasure. In other words, just having all the sensory pleasures. You know, the huge plasma screen TV where he's watching a movie. You know, the big internet with all the internet games, and whatever else is the pleasures of our life these days. And sees some householder's son furnished with now with all his sensory enjoyments, enjoying himself with them. And he considered us, formerly when we were in our home life, we were furnished and endowed with the five courses of sensual pleasure, and we enjoyed ourselves with them. You know, I could play my video games, I could watch the movies, I could watch MTV and dance, you know, with Lady Gaga or whatever. So I could do all of these things. But now I can't. So that tendency where you see with your senses unguarded, with mindfulness unestablished, going into people's houses or going into the city itself and seeing all the pleasures which people can enjoy, which as monks we can't. And he thinks to himself, my family has wealth. I can both enjoy my wealth and also make good karma, even meditate. So why do I want to be a monk? So he forsakes the training, reverts to the low life. He is called one who has forsaken the training, reverting to the low life, because he was frightened by the danger of whirlpools. Now whirlpools is a term for the sensory pleasures. The five cores mean sensory pleasures from the eye, from the ear, the nose, the mouth, and the body. And that's, again, the idea of a whirlpool sucking you in. At first doesn't seem all that dangerous. You just play a video game or something. It's good fun, but it sucks you in, going faster and faster and deeper till you can't get out. You know, it's like an addiction. And I don't know how many parents keep on telling me, my son, he spends all the time in his room playing video games. I can't get him out. Or spending all the time just watching movies, or just being an addict to this and addict to that. And that is the five sense pleasures. They're a whirlpool, they drag you in. And remember, the way to liberation is described by the Buddha is letting go of those five sense pleasures, detaching from them, which is what we do in meditation, sitting down so the sight disappears, the sound disappears, smells and tastes and feelings in the body disappear, and they can only disappear when you calm them down and subdue them. When indulging in the sense pleasures, it excites the mind and actually strengthens the addiction to that five sense world. So it is not benign, you know, to see the movie. You see a movie, you want to see another one. It's not benign to, you know, play the video game. You do one, you want another one. That's one of the problems. There's an addictiveness to the sense pleasures. That's why by restraining them, you get a sense of freedom from them. You're not sort of led like a bull with a ring through its nose and a string attached to the ring. You're not led by the nose, by the pleasures of the senses. You can resist them if you want. You can take them if you want, but you're not controlled by them. And a lot of times we think that, yeah, we're not controlled by them. But it's amazing just how many people, you have to watch that movie which is on the TV tonight. And you rush back after the talk to kind of watch that movie. You have to catch the end of that cricket match. You have to sort of see whatever else is happening. It's an addiction. So they call that, especially for the monks and the nuns, the addiction to the whirlpools. You know, the five senses, getting sucked in there. Because it's tough. other people, you know, we as monks and nuns, we go to people's houses, you know, you invite us to do a blessing in your house. So please make sure, you know, the TV is turned on. Otherwise it just draws you in. What's on there? And you say, wow, that's a good movie, I haven't seen that yet. And you went, I want to see it. And sometimes the monk saying, well, you know, why do I need to be a monk and have all these rules? I can meditate and see the movies as well. But you find your meditation doesn't go as deep. So that's the fear of whirlpools, sensory pleasures. I got a question there, yes.
Thanks, Ajahn. So that is a good teaching, but I had a glance at Analeo's comparative study, comparing it with the Agamas, and apparently that isn't in the Agama version. So I was just wondering if that teaching, because it's good, if it's found elsewhere in the suttas.
Which teaching was that about?
The four whirlpools. He said it's not in the Ekotara Agama. Instead, there is something, nine something else, but I forget. But if you can clarify, and then if those four things are found elsewhere, because they're very helpful.
Yes. I didn't do my preparation as much as I should. They've embarrassed me on the internet world. Does not matter. But there is, it's an interesting point there, that we have these suttas here which have come down in the Theravada tradition. We also have the Agamas, which were preserved in the Chinese tradition. And in the Agamas, the similar suttas, much of it is the same, but the interesting part is where the Agamas and the Pali versions differ. And where they differ, we realize that sometimes the Pali version is the more pure form, but sometimes the Agamas are quite clearly the more authentic form. And it's difficult to understand which one is more authentic. Obviously, in this sutta, the Chattama Sutta, the Buddha is going to be teaching those monks, because after he dismissed them and reconciled, he made the point you should be quiet when you come into a monastery, not make too much noise. And then, having reconciled, it's obviously that he would be giving them a teaching to show that the reconciliation had happened. And these were obviously, by their conduct of being very noisy when they came into a monastery, were almost certainly very young monks. And he was teaching them something to keep them as monks for a bit longer by showing them four dangers. Whether it was original to this sutta or not, it does fit this sutta. The Agama could be incorrect, or this could be the correct version, I'm not sure, but this would be the sort of thing which the Buddha would teach. So it makes sense to me that this sounds authentic. And it fulfills, as just the other, it's in line with the other teachings you find in this book. As a general principle, something which I got when I visited Venerable Jnanatiloka, who was one of the translators of this book. This is Jnanamoli. Jnanatiloka, he did some other translations. A very famous German monk, and I managed to see him before he passed away in Sri Lanka. And when we were discussing, you know, the Dhamma, you know, he said one thing which really struck a chord with me, and I remember to this day. There's one way of reading these suttas. He said, never interpret what you read in these suttas in light of one or two obscure passages. Because there are some obscure passages which you see somewhere. Rather, interpret the obscure passages in light of all the other very clear teachings repeated many times. So when there is anything which, you know, is a bit ambiguous, which can be read in two ways, don't make a great importance of that. Where it's very, very clear, that is important, and then interpret the ambiguous passages in light of what's very, very clear. Good example, the Eightfold Path. Always, always, always is the way to become enlightened. That is the path to enlightenment, Eightfold Path. That is repeated so many times in these books, it is just well known. So when we come across, say, the first verses in the Satipatthana Sutta, where some people sort of interpret the phrase Ekaya Namaga as the only way to become enlightened. You shouldn't interpret the whole of the suttas, you know, in terms of just that one interpretation that Satipatthana is the only way to become enlightened. Instead, you should interpret that passage, Ekaya Namaga, in terms of all the other teachings in the suttas. In other words, the Eightfold Path is the only way. So what can that phrase really mean? Interpreted in light of all the other massive, many times repeated teachings of the Buddha. And then it really is obvious that it cannot mean the only way. And what most people say these days, it's a direct way, it's a way leading to only the one direction. But the only way is the Eightfold Path. That's an example of not taking one ambiguous line and interpreting the whole of the Buddhism in terms of one ambiguous line. Instead, taking all the massive teachings of Buddhism and then taking those ambiguous lines which people debate over, interpret those ambiguous lines in light of the massive teachings of the Buddha, which are very clear. It's a very obvious statement, but people still make a mistake, and they still focus on one or two little lines and interpret the whole of the teachings on that. And these four similes here are very much in line with the massive rest of the teachings of the Buddha. So that's why I say that these are probably authentic. And the last of the dangers when entering the water in a simile is the fear of sharks. Now I'm going to, for the sake of gender equality here, I'm going to just swap this around. What, bhikkhunis, is the fear of sharks? Here some trans woman goes forth out of faith from the home in life into homelessness, considering, I am a victim of birth, aging and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. Then after she has gone forth, thus when it gets to morning, she dresses and taking her bowl and outer robe, she goes into village or town for alms. With her body unguarded, speech unguarded, mindfulness unestablished, and with her sense faculties unrestrained, she sees a man there, lightly clothed, lightly dressed, athletic, good-looking, blonde, blue-eyed, whatever people like. Okay, just turning around a bit for interest. When she sees such a man, lust infects her mind. Because her mind has been affected by lust, she forsakes the training and reverts to the low life. She is called one who has forsaken the training and reverted to the low life because she was frightened by the fear of sharks. Now, sharks here is a term for men. Now, I just say that because sometimes, if I read it out as it was, some people interpret that as misogynist monks hating women. But what it really is here is it's just whenever you are celibate, the opposite gender can be a distraction for you. There is one disciple, fortunately she's not here today. She went off to India on pilgrimage, and after going off to India on pilgrimage, she went up to Dhammasara. And to see the Dalai Lama, I don't think she got an audience with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, but she was staying there for a few days, and so there was a morning meditation. She went to the morning meditation, and who would sit right next to her but Richard Gere? And she said her meditation was shot. She had no peace, no tranquility. She couldn't watch her breath because sitting right next to her, Richard Gere. I mean, this was many years ago when he really was young and good looking. So that's a good example of a danger of a shark. And lust goes both ways, as we all know. So, they say that sharks here is a term, I would not say like women or men, just it's for lust, for that desire. And obviously, if you are celibate, that's what happens. And you know that many sort of monks, you know, many nuns, they actually do disrobe. Because they say with speech unguarded, mindfulness unestablished, sense faculties unrestrained, you see a woman or a man there, attractively attired, and dust infects the mind, and because of this, after a while, you decide to leave. So many. I see that in all the years I've been a monk, that's usually why monks disrobe. They may give all sorts of other reasons. Well, no, some, and they have got health problems. But the major reason why monks disrobe, you know, is because of lust. It's a hard thing to do. in this society. Imagine a monk, you know, that there you see beautiful women come into a monastery. I will never forget this poor young monk. You know, he's really young. And it was Arkatina Day at Bodhidharma Monastery. And there was lots of cars outside. This is quite a few years ago. And because there's lots of cars outside, you know, some visitors, they realized something was going on. They decided to come and have a look what was going on. And these two young girls, I mean, they really looked like they'd just come out of a nightclub. I mean, no, even I could recognize that. And just, you know, really sort of dressed up to the nines. And instead of coming to me, who can handle this sort of stuff, and ask me questions, they chose this youngest of monks who just ordained, and they went straight up to him and started chatting to him. And I managed to rescue him in time. And he told me, he disappeared. And I said, where did you go? He said, I had to lie down for 2 hours. It's a monk, poor things. So be kind to them. So poor old monk. I felt sorry for him. Really unfair, but he's a really good guy as well. So, but that's why we, you know, try and be a bit restrained. And so in the early stories, is one of the monks is many years ago. This was the Ajahn Kanti Pala, and he was invited to teach some meditation at this retreat up in a place called Nimbin in Queensland. And for those of you who know that place, that was like the hippie colony. And they were having like sort of some pop concert. They just wanted a monk there because the monks were really cool in those days. And they were to teach meditation. So he was in this tent teaching meditation, which was fine. But, you know, then a few sort of naked girls came in as well because, you know, they were just, what's wrong with having clothes, no clothes on? So the poor old monk was sitting there in front of, you know, just not old ladies, you know, really young ladies sitting there with no clothes on at all. And, you know, the monks in Thailand were not used to that. So always amazing little stories. We make fun of it. But, you know, for some monks, you know, have, you know, tendencies to lust. They get a bit sort of, you know, hot and poor things. And it's the same with girls as well. Sometimes we fall in love. So that's the fear of sharks. You know, the term for the opposite gender. They can bite you. So monks, there are these four kinds of dangers to be expected by certain persons, not all persons, certain persons who have gone forth from the home life into homelessness in this Dharma discipline. That is what the Blessed One said, and the monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that's the Chatumā Sutta, and it hasn't been discussed here before, and because it doesn't really go too deep, you know, into the Dharma, but it shows a lot about monastic life. And just the dangers of monastic life and just the celibacy. But with celibacy, which has become an important topic of conversation in these days, these are sort of some dangers of celibacy and simplicity and restraint. But you cannot just rely upon just restraint, you know, to overcome these dangers. The way to overcome them is, first of all, it's mentioned here, whenever you go into the town, the village, the houses, that you should go guarded, with your body guarded, with your speech guarded, with mindfulness established, and with the sense faculties restrained. Just keep sort of within yourself. Because usually what happens, you know, the more you go out, the more you send your mind outwards, the more unrestrained you are, you get caught up in things. As you know, that so easy to get caught up in conversations. You start a talk and it goes on and on and on and on, and sometimes you say, what a waste of time that was, but you got caught up in it. Sometimes you get caught up in other sort of little addictions and things which we think are good fun. And so by having restraint, the sense faculties restrained, keeping them within rather than sending them out, and having our mindfulness established, that means that when you, if you are a meditator, someone who is dedicated to a simple lifestyle, when you go out into the town, you don't sort of get caught up into things. For monks in Bodhinyana Monastery, they're very, very good monks, but one of the things I'm more and more concerned about is when they go into, not the houses or the villages, when they go into Bunnings. So they have to be very careful to guard their senses, because this is boys and boys' toys. you know, monks or boys, and they go into Bunnings, they have to keep their senses restrained. Oh, that's a really sort of good drill. Oh, look at that saw. Oh, look at that. We need one of those in our monastery. So I tell people that's, you know, if I was teaching this sutta, I would have the fifth fear, the fear of boys' toys. In other words, going to Bunnings. So I tell people, if you go into Bunnings, internationally, Bunnings is a big chain, of like a big hardware and do-it-yourself tool place. And so that's something which will be the fifth fear or the fifth danger, the danger of hardware stores. So you have to go into those with sense faculties restrained, mindfulness established, but with your body and speech restrained. Otherwise you end up costing the Buddhist Society of West Australia a lot of money. Okay, so those are the fears, to make sure the dangers of monastic life. And remember, the Buddha was talking to the monks here, so I want to make sure those monks got a good start in the monastic life. And after the restraints is established and the faculties are sort of restrained, the defilements are restrained, don't go out so much, it's much easier to get into deep meditation, because you know, your mind is settled inside. And because it's a peaceful mind, later on you can get into the deep meditations. And when you go into the very deep meditations, it's so joyful, it's so peaceful, it's so blissful, it's so insightful that these dangers don't even affect you anymore. You don't see sort of a woman as a sex object, you see as a person. You see as a person who is female rather than a female person. And you don't see sort of the sense pleasures as something which is attractive. You see them more like a bit of an irritation. Just, why do I have to do these things? It was just, you know, caused me so much disturbance to my peace. And you don't look upon food as something which is, you know, you want to take. It's something you have to take just to keep your body going. Just, you know, quite a pain. I remember one monk said, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have just one pill and had all the vitamins and all the proteins and everything else, you know, which you need for one day, and just take one pill a day and that would be it. I put my hand up for that. The amount of time monks have to spend eating, you know, we go on this alms round, we've got to give the chanting beforehand and the precepts, and then we have to go on the alms round so you can actually, you know, go make some merit. And then we have to wait upstairs for all the other monks. By that time your food's gone cold, stone cold. It may have been sort of, you know, hot when you put it in your bowl, but by the time you eat it by giving all these chanting and stuff, it's really cold. It takes so much time, monks eating. And if it's just one pill, just take it in there 5 minutes and then you can go back to meditation. It'd be really, really good. So I'll be one for that. And that was actually one of the monks suggested that. So that's, you know, those other dangers. And about the rules, you know, the rules are just keeping things simple. So when you're a senior monk and you've got some meditation under your belt, then you're not really concerned about these things. So that's the sutta there. Now, are there any other questions which anybody would like to ask here? And just before I say that, if there's anybody who's listening on the internet who wishes to ask a question about this sutta, please go on the chat, it's called. Not the text or SMS, it's the chat section. And then you can ask a question. Yes?
You started off about noise.
Yes.
And we've had a bit of a dilemma at the nuns' monastery, especially during the school holidays. Children come along there and they really play up. And you can see the parents don't hear it, they don't see it. And you can see... you can see that the nuns are not sure what to do about it. And then I might say to Ainsley, should I go over? And he says, it's not your business, keep out of it, otherwise you'll upset the mothers. So what do you do in the situation? Because it really is bad. It's got worse.
Yeah, it does. That is a dilemma for me. I think the Dhammasala Nuns Monastery gets worse than we get at Bodhinyana Monastery, but you know, we get kids running around sometimes too. And in one sense, it's kids being kids, and at least they get a sense that the monastery is a welcoming place for them. Because as a kids, you know, you can't really teach them much. They're kids. But at least this is one of the places where they grow, where they get to know the monks and the nuns. So later on in their life, you know, they can look upon that place as a place where they're familiar with and they feel comfortable with. If it's a place where all the kids have to remain quiet and they're not enjoying themselves, then when they grow older, they won't want to go to that monastery anymore. They think this is boring, harsh old monastery. It gives them the wrong attitude early on in life.
But, excuse me, Arjun, can't we sort of separate and say, well, that's okay outside there, which we don't particularly like as growing up, but that's okay outside.
Yeah.
But to be in the hall making such a noise is...
That's a good idea, yes. Mm. So have the areas there where they can play around, but when they're actually in the hall, maybe they have to keep quiet. It's usually that, you know, when they're up in the dana sala, the dining room of Bodhinyana, they're usually reasonably well behaved. I think it's because there's so many monks, they feel a bit intimidated. Mm. There's not that many nuns around.
Mm.
But okay. It's a difficult one, kids being kids, but I do remember just going to a church and told you have to be quiet, you can't say anything. And I felt afraid and intimidated. You never wanted to go in a place like that anymore. So when I see kids having fun in a monastery, I realize they feel welcome. And I know later on in life that they will come back, especially when they need it. But it's true that it does make it very difficult for the monks and the nuns. Maybe what you can do is actually to offer the nuns earplugs, so that they can put the earplugs in, or the kids are running around.
So you don't agree with the lay people even trying to say, well?
Of course, the lay people can say that, but they have to get support from the nuns. Otherwise, you know, you're out on a limb, someone will tell you, "Don't interfere. Who do you think you are, Barbara?"
That's a difficult.
It's a difficult, yeah. So I think if we can get a uniform for you, a nice black cap and a stripes.
Thank you for a job.
But it really should be up to the nuns or the monks to do that, because they have authority. Unfortunately, I know this from personal experience, that as a senior monk, you're stuck up there talking to a person. You can't tell somebody to, you know, tell them to be quiet, because there's two or three people you're talking to. So sometimes it'd be good for the second or the third monk or the second or the third nun to actually take on that responsibility. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Because as monks, we have a really quiet life. It's very peaceful and silent. And it's just jarring to your ears sometimes. If you feel it's noisy, imagine how the nuns feel. Yeah. But that's life. You can't do much about that. In the end, there's a great teaching of Ajahn Chah, and I always come back to this. It's not the noise that disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. Kids are kids. And sure, this is probably their karma, though we park it, because they probably were even more noisy when that Hasapanyu in the road, they were probably running around making and screaming their heads off when they were that age. I know I was. Are there any questions from me?
Yes, Ajahn, there are indeed. First of all, I want to let you know you had 25 people join us today.
Ah, excellent.
There's actually two questions from one person, Ying Eng from Western Australia, and he wants to know, can non-returners attain nibbana without jhana?
Can non-returners attain nibbana without jhanas? You can't be a non-returner without jhanas. You've already got jhana to be a non-returner. If you want to have a look at that, it's on 64, three suttas back, the Maha Mulunkyaputta Sutta. And there you will find the Buddha saying that it's impossible to become an anagami, a non-returner, without the jhanas. Just as it's impossible to get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and sapwood. So you do need to have a jhana to get to be an anagami. You've already got the jhanas. And once you are an anagami, you have totally eradicated, you know, your attachment to the five sense world. So there is no barrier at all between you and the jhanas. It's just as easy just to step through a door. It's no without any difficulty. And all the stories, the descriptions of anagamis you see in the suttas, people like Chitta the householder, Uga, who was another householder, the story of Gatikara from the time of Kassapa the Buddha, all of those anagamis described by the Buddha all had easy access to the jhanas without difficulty. That was one of the descriptions of the non-returner, the ease with which they could enter jhana. So the answer to the question, you have to have the jhana before you become an anagami. Once you are an anagami, it's as easy as anything.
And they have to continue going into jhana as part of their practice.
It's not a question of they having to. It's like the default on your computer. If there's nothing to do, the screen turns off. And that's the jhana. Stages of letting go. It's not something you have to do. It's something you can't stop doing.
Okay, thank you for that, Arjun. And the other question that Ying Eng wants to know was, what are the pure abodes?
What are the pure abodes? These are mind-made realms, Manomayakaya realms. So this is the places where a person who has abandoned the five senses, living in the realm of the mind, and being probably spending a lot of the time in the jhana realms and coming out again, and basically your world is very much a mental world, not a physical world. And obviously, just because there's no body, no pain, no good example of this is that you are not born as a baby in the pseudo-vasa, so you don't have the problem they have in the nuns' monastery with kids running around screaming. There are no kids in the pseudo-vasa. They're just mature beings. And you don't get old and grey, and you don't have bad legs or bad hearing in the pseudo-vasa, because there is just appear there, and eventually if you do pass away from any of these heavenly realms, you just fade away and disappear. So no old age homes, no dementia, no sort of hospitals. So that's pretty a nice place to hang out. And you hang out there for a while, and when you do fade away from the non-returner realm, that's it. Your cessation, that's nibbana.
Thank you.
So is that any other questions there?
That's it, thanks.
Okay. So thank you for those questions, and thank you for listening on the internet for 25 people, and please tell your friends, and especially not just your friends, your enemies, because they need it more than anybody. This will be happening again in 2 weeks' time. So let's now pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantā abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅghaṃ namāmi.